Unbranded on CliffCentral.com.
Welcome back to Unbranded. I'm Timothy Maurice, and this is the show where we explore the intersection between human and brand behavior. And today, we're going to look at that intersection from the perspective of art. Few forms of human behavior are more impactful than art. How has art shaped South Africa and Africa and the rest of the world? Today we'll explore how fine art in particular influences the perception of how sophisticated people are, and moreover, how fine art can inspire the nation's psyche in terms of other creative industries such as fashion, architecture, and so much more. And the reality is art has been around before language, and I suppose it'll be here long after we're gone. I think it's perhaps mankind's greatest contribution to the world. Beyond being a decorative offering, it is a representation of a people's soul, heart, and mind. And today, I am very fortunate and lucky and delighted to be able to have this conversation with Miss Pulani Kingston. She's an art aficionado, a private collector, and someone who just loves the beautiful things in the world and has a perspective from around the world about this subject. So welcome to the show, Pulani.
Thank you very much, Timothy, and I appreciate you having me on your show.
It's a thrill. And people and the listeners, if you're hanging out, you know, feel free to email me, Timothy@TimothyMaurice.com, or tweet us at CliffCentral.com, and engage the conversation. You know, when you think about fine art, you know, people typically have a particular perspective, and we want to engage your thoughts as well. You know, I'm really interested in just thinking about, Pulani, just African art. I mean, let's just go back a bit. You know, the oldest images scientifically dated are in Namibia, the Apollo 11 cave, from about 27,000 years ago, yet most experts agree that Africa's rock art may date to more than 50,000 years. Isn't it incredible how little, do you think, how little people really know about how old art is?
It is incredible, but it's not too late to learn about it. One of the exhibitions, for instance, that is currently on show is at the Wits Art Museum, and it is the William Battis exhibition, which talks through his life as an artist. And one of his greatest inspirations, in fact, in his earlier years, was around rock art and sand art. So it's rather fascinating to see how that influence has carried throughout his artistic career.
Sure.
So well worth the trip to go there. It is also beautifully curated, very simple and straightforward to understand. So I highly recommend it.
And how long will it be on?
It'll be on until the end of October, if my memory serves me well.
Awesome. Yep. Now, for those who have no idea who Pulani Kingston is, let's just go back. You have sort of lived in many places in the world, but where were you born?
I was born in a beautiful city called Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, which is on the East African coast.
Okay. And from there, you moved?
Well, I lived there for the first 18 years of my life, and in between, during that time, I lived throughout East and Southern Africa, including Botswana and Zambia. At the age of 18, I moved to the UK to study, and after that, I came to South Africa in 1991.
Okay, and you have political sort of heritage as well. Some of your family members were in the, you know, sort of struggle, so to speak.
Yes, my parents were political exiles, having left South Africa in 1961. And when Nelson Mandela was freed in 1990, we all made our way back to South Africa. So I always laugh when people say, so when did you come back to South Africa? I actually didn't come back. I came to South Africa.
I see.
In August 1991, after I had completed my master's degree.
Okay. And you speak how many languages?
I speak about 5 languages, some better than others. Obviously English.
Yes.
I speak conversational French. I lived in Norway at a point in time during my teenage years, so I do understand Norwegian. I speak Zulu, Sotho, Xhosa, Tswana, and so it goes.
Awesome.
I'd like to see myself as a citizen of the world.
Got it. Now, this is a conversation I think that everyone should be interested in, particularly because art, you know, it informs so much about how we see the world and how we engage the world. Even if you're aware of it or not, you don't have to be one of these people who every weekend go and experience art. I think if you're listening now, hang out with us for the next sort of 45 minutes, because I think you're going to be intrigued just how valuable this conversation is to you, the nation's identity, how we feel about South Africa, how we feel about the continent, and so forth. When did you fall in love with art?
I can't remember when I fell in love with art, but I remember art being all around me from a very early age. So my earliest memory, for instance, was that at a very young age, I went to boarding school in a small town called Arusha in Tanzania. And I then went on to secondary school in another small town called Moshi. So anyone who knows anything about that part of the world will appreciate the fact that the one most majestic piece of artistic beauty lies in that part of the world, and it's Mount Kilimanjaro. Every morning, for the first 18 years of my life, for so long as I wasn't, for so long as I was at school, I looked out on Mount Kilimanjaro. It literally shaped my appreciation of aesthetic beauty, of beauty around me. It's one of the most beautiful parts of the world. It's lush, it's green. And to wake up in the morning with the first view that you see being an ice-capped mountain has got to be one of the most beautiful artistic sights to behold. So that was my first real appreciation of beauty. My parents, being political exiles, of course, spent a lot of time traveling away from us. And one of the people who had a very, very profound impact on my appreciation and understanding of art is a photographer who came from Latvia. He was a member of the South African Communist Party, and he moved into exile and lived in Dar es Salaam. So during the holidays, when I was between the ages of 8 and 11, I lived with Uncle Eli. And Uncle Eli was actually a photographer whose full name is Eli Weinberg, and is one of our greatest photographers in the context of South African history. I'm not sure if you've seen this fabulous portrait of Nelson Mandela wearing his traditional beads.
Oh, yes.
That was Eli Weinberg, the photographer. So I spent many, many hours with Uncle Eli in his dark room, learning about how to produce photographs. And he taught me a lot about how to technically appreciate good photography from bad photography. And interestingly enough, he was also the first person to teach me the African National Congress anthem perfectly. So it was interesting that it was a Jewish person who actually taught me the song. And I have many other aunts. I mean, one of my other aunts, her name is Lindiwe Mabuza, Ambassador Lindiwe Mabuza. We call her the diva. She was always interested in the art. She loved the art. She's a poet. She's a politician. She's a feminist. She imbibed and imbued in us a love for the arts, be it visual arts, performing arts, poetry, writing. She was the go-to person, and in a sense continues to be. She's a collector, and she taught us to appreciate art, and in particular its role in our lives and its role in society and its role as a social commentary of the times in which we live.
Sure. Imagine a world without art. If you're listening and you are just sort of tuning in, we're chatting to Pulani Kingston on a daily basis. You work as a lawyer.
Yes, I'm a partner at a firm called Weber Wenzel in Sandton.
Yeah, and your background is sort of a fusion between sort of finance and law.
I specialize as an oil and gas practitioner.
Okay.
Yep.
Got it. Now, I want to go to a song quickly. It's a song that you want that you find interesting. And we want to chat about this song when we come back, as we go back into sort of this art conversation. But what you can expect for the next sort of 30 minutes is we're going to go into how sort of African art and art in general can impact a nation's identity. We'll be right back. Wow. You know, music is art. Art moves the world forward. And I asked earlier, imagine a world without art. I can't. I mean, imagine a home without an aesthetic to stimulate the soul and the mind. Today we chat about how art impacts a nation's identity, how fine art has sort of shaped even race relations around the world, how fine art has sort of informed how we see each other and each other's capacity to engage, and ultimately undergirded the role of civilization and how we trade and how we engage from a commerce perspective. It has an extraordinary role in who we are and how we have formed ourselves as a civilized people. And African art is perhaps one of the most undervalued sort of commodity in the world relative to its actual power and influence. So as we end Women's Month, we decided that we would bring in sort of a leading thinker, woman, a professional, Polani Kingston, to have a conversation with us and basically almost co-host. How do you like the title of co-host, Polani?
I'm not sure about that.
This is, I guess this will probably be your first co-hosting. And it's your first time on Cliff Central as well, right?
Indeed.
Welcome to Cliff Central again.
Thank you.
And I hope Women's Month has been rewarding for you. I know that a lot of, you know, sort of influential women often feel two ways about this conversation around Women's Month. Some feel as though it can be patronizing. Others feel as though we need to raise bigger issues and not just have celebrations. How do you feel about Women's Month?
This particular Women's Month has been one where I have been rather reflective. First of all, of the significant gains over the years that have been made insofar as gender equity and the emancipation of women has been concerned. But also specifically, not specific to South Africa, but given the overall dearth of leadership across the globe, it's been a time for reflection for me, because I have found that we have taken a few steps backwards insofar as the struggle for issues that particularly impact women are concerned. And I have made it my business to take time to think about the responsibility that I have and the role that I need to play in order to get us back on track. Because I certainly want to make sure that the world that I leave behind for my children and successors is a better one than that Sure. in which we're living today.
And that's a perfect way to bring us back to this arts conversation, because, you know, if you think about the role that women have played in terms of their contribution to the art world, often it's really sort of, again, undervalued, just as African art is, as I mentioned earlier. Share with us a few of your favorite female artists.
Okay, so given that it is Women's Month and that we're coming to the end of it, I chose to focus on four or five contemporary African artists. There are many artists of different generations who have played a role in the social commentary of the times, both as fine artists as well as aesthetic or decorative artists, to put it that way. But I'm also struck by the fact that across the world, as with many other professions, one sees that there are very few women artists generally. And that's something that I've been trying to get my brain around, because we are a creative, we are Yes. creative people. And in Africa in particular, we are not seeing, as many women artists coming to the fore and really establishing themselves, not only in their countries and on the continent or globally. We're just seeing that there's a lack in that regard. But funnily enough, there are a couple of extraordinary contemporary African artists okay. who are female. artists who have come to the fore in our time, artists who were born between 1963 and 1983. That's the period in which I've focused, and they come from different parts of the continent. So artists such as Wangechi Mutu, who is Kenyan, Ndijeka Akunyili Crosby, who is originally from Nigeria, another artist called Gada Amer, who is Egyptian, lives in the States, as well as an Ethiopian an artist of Ethiopian descent called Julie Meretu. She's a phenomenal abstract artist, also lives in the States. And then the last one that I identified and have been following quite closely is a South African young woman called Zanele Muholi. She is absolutely extraordinary. She's a photographer and a visual activist. And all of these women speak to similar themes. They focus on gender, they focus on race, they focus on colonialism, or rather colonialism. And one of the things I find rather interesting is in their work, they also talk to your post-colonial stereotypes and issues around how the world has oversimplified the lives of African people, in that Africans are seen from the perspective of having either good safari lodges to visit or interesting erotic cultures. So what these artists have sought to do is to challenge the stereotype and to introduce the layers upon layers, whether it's in terms of how they paint layers or in terms of the subject matter that they draw on, which really focuses on the fact that like any other human being, we are as complex or as simple as we want to be.
Wow. And these artists that you mentioned, you know, for the average person, if we were to just sort of do research and we were to go throughout South Africa and we would ask how many people know about these artists, I feel even guilty. I didn't know about them. One of them, I think, from the Ethiopian, I'd heard of slightly, but not really. I'm not going to act deep. How many people would you think? What percentage of the population would know about these artists?
It's a very, very small percentage.
Less than 5%?
Absolutely. Well, one of them, in the context of South Africa, for instance, Zanele Muholi, we may not remember her name, but she's the one who focuses her work on creating positive images of black lesbians and transgender people in South African society. And you'll recall that in 2009, when we had our then Minister of Arts and Culture, Lulu Xingwana, she was invited to her exhibition called Faces and Phases. And Lulu Xingwana was so disgusted by what she saw in this photography, namely lesbian people being intimate with one another, that she called her work immoral.
Do you remember this?
So this is Zanele Muholi. She still focuses on portraying and making sure that your LGBTI community has a face and that they are assimilated into society. But she's now turned to a series called Being, and she's turned that lens onto herself. And the issue there is what she's done is she's started creating these self-portraits, which are phenomenal, and they focus on her identity as a black woman. And what I find very interesting is she's drawn, I think, from Kerry J. Marshall, who's an American artist who actually happens to be one of my very, very favorite artists. She focuses the lens on accentuating the beauty of blackness, the beauty of skin color, and in all of her self-portraits, her skin is phenomenal. It is dark, it is lush, it is rich. And in those various portraits, she basically explores how the women in her family, her friends, her relatives regard themselves from the perspective of their skin color. And in those eyes, which she captures so beautifully, are a multiplicity of stories. Stories of triumph, stories of trials, stories of challenges in life. So she is a powerful artist, very young. I have no doubt that despite the fact that she has already achieved international acclaim, she will remain at the top of her game and will go down in history as one of South Africa's greatest photographers and visual activists.
And as she evolves and as she grows, and she puts South Africa's sort of art community on the map.
Yeah.
This brings us back to our conversation around an identity, a nation's identity and the role of art.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about the link between history and where we are currently and what the potential could potentially hold if we understand African art a little bit better. Yes.
So I think one of the first things before we even begin to understand African art a little better is that we need to understand African history a whole lot better. I think that our curricula at school needs to be augmented substantially so that we focus on our history, because our history is incredible. We have made significant yet undervalued contributions to the world, and an understanding of history enables us then to appreciate the fine art that is produced today.
Sure.
By some of these incredible women.
That's a good point. And I think, you know, maybe we should have another whole show about this whole history thing. But I want to talk about quickly, for those who just sort of tuning in, we're talking African art, we're talking art in general and fine art and the role it plays in shaping a nation's identity. I want to talk about some of the various forms of art that Africa is sort of known for. So, for example, artistic creativity, expressive individualism. I know that, you know, in West African art in particular, there is a widespread emphasis on expressive individualism while simultaneously being influenced by the work of predecessors. There's an emphasis on the human figure. The human figure has always been the primary subject of matter for most African art, and the emphasis even influenced certain European traditions. There's visual abstraction. African artworks tend to favor visual abstraction over naturalistic representation, although this is changing, and a lot of this is changing. We're just going back and talking about the history. This is because many African artworks generalize stylistic norms, ancient Egyptian art, etc., and so forth. There's an emphasis on sculpture. African artists tend to favor three-dimensional artworks over two-dimensional artworks. Even many African paintings or cloth works were meant to be experienced three-dimensionally. House paintings are often seen as continuous designs wrapped around a house, forcing the viewer to walk around the work to experience it fully. And then there's non-linear scaling. Often a small part of African design will look similar to a larger part, such as the diamonds at different scales in the Kasai patterns, and so forth. How far off am I?
You're not far off. You're not far off at all.
Okay.
It's interesting that you talk to the three-dimensional nature of a lot of art that's produced by African artists. One of the things that I find so interesting is how that is becoming more and more recognized and appreciated for its stylistic, stylistic form. One of the artists that I mentioned, in fact, I didn't mention this artist, but let me mention her anyway. Gada Amma. She is an Egyptian artist who moved from Egypt and then to France during the period of violence in Egypt, and then ultimately in 1996 with her family, she moved to the U.S. What's interesting about her is that she paid a U.S. lawyer through a piece of one of her works to secure her a green card. And I think it was a win-win outcome. She got her green card, and the value of that piece of art was $4,000 at the time. But today, that piece of art is worth over $125,000.
Wow.
So the artist, I think, made a killing in the process.
Wow.
So her work focuses a lot on exploring female sexuality and the subjugation of women across cultures. And what I find so interesting about her work is that she uses the canvas, but she also uses stitching. So she uses fine point stitching, and she gets pornographic images which she superimposes onto canvases, and then she uses the stitching to embroider different images. A lot of the times it's words, sometimes it's flowers, but it's just to speak of how women, we need to look beyond what is fed to us in terms of the lack of a multidimensional approach to what is black and what is African. And there's this one particular painting of hers called Silver Girl, where she's used a pornographic image, but over it she has embroidered the words, "I want a zero tolerance policy on all patriarchal bullshit." So it's just repeated. The sentence is repeated across this canvas, and it is incredibly impactful. She uses a very soft palette for the image, which is a nude, but the words in and of themselves speak a different language, and they almost desexualize, de-eroticize this pornographic image. So again, I would say that's one other form of looking at the layering, also looking at the three-dimensional element. There's another South African artist whose work I really enjoy. His name is Nicholas Hlobo, and his work is internationally renowned. I mean, he has at the Tate Modern in London, his work is featured as an important part of the African exhibition. He has work at some of the most renowned US galleries and museums. He lives in Johannesburg in a deconsecrated shul, which is also quite fascinating. But he actually tears the canvas, and he gives it a three-dimensional feel. So he calls his work paintings, but not a drop of paint touches the canvas.
Wow.
And he uses ribbons, and he uses leather to create this three-dimensional feel and look and feel to his work. And again, his work is talking about the South Africa that we broke apart prior to 1994, and using the ribbon, which is identified with femininity, he has stitched. He stitches back what it is that he dreams for the South Africa that we all want to live in. So the themes continue through the ages.
I get it. And one of the things that, you know, when we start talking about fine art, you make me think about, for example, you know, how fine art oftentimes is seen superficially, but, you know, when you really dig deep into it, you know, the most influential fine art addresses some sort of historical, social dynamic. Mm-hmm. And I want to just sort of define it. I mean, if you go online, any Google, or you just sort of dig deep enough, fine art usually is developed primarily for aesthetic or beauty, distinguished it from applied art, that it also has to serve some practical function. Historically, the five main fine arts were painting, sculpture, architecture, music, and poetry, with performing arts including theater and dance. Today, the fine arts commonly include additional forms such as film, photography, video production, editing, design, sequential art, and so forth. However, in some institutes of learning or in museums, fine art, and frequently the term fine arts as well, are associated exclusively with visual art forms. When you think of fine art, what comes to mind?
I think of fine art not only as visual art, but performing arts, photography, editing, or everything that you said, I think, constitutes fine art. But I do differentiate between fine art and decorative art. Because I think that decorative art is beautiful. There's nothing wrong with it, by the way. It's beautiful to look at. It gives you a great feeling, or it disturbs you. However, fine art for me is more around the technical competence of the artist. It's whether or not the artist is actually conscientizing you in the context of what it is that they have produced. It talks to whether the artist has been validated internationally, and by that I mean where they have exhibited their work? Have they exhibited their work internationally at some of the most renowned museums and art institutes? Have they had solo shows? Have they exhibited at your biennales and triennales? Have they exhibited, for instance, have they been invited to Documenta, which is one of the most exclusive and well-regarded art fairs. I'd say it's an art fair for intellectuals. So that really is where your top artists, fine artists in the world, are invited to not only exhibit their work, but to also engage around their work and what it talks to from a historic perspective, as well as looking forward into the future. So Southern African context, artists such as William Kentridge have been invited to Documenta on a number of occasions. One of my favorite up-and-coming artists, whose name is Kudzanai Chiurai, he's Zimbabwean. He's also been invited to exhibit his works at Documenta, as has Nandipa Mtambo, who is also one of our great up-and-coming young female artists.
When you think about some of the most influential sort of artists in the world and what they've done for their countries, I mean, you can't deny the fact that when you think about someone like Da Vinci and how people feel about Italy, which artist on this continent has made people feel, give me a number of them outside of the ones you've named, that make people feel extremely proud to say they're African? That link, that history, and what they've been able to produce and how they've impacted the continent or their country in general.
Well, there are so many. There are so many. I would say I'd start off with someone like Julie Meretu of our generation. She was born in 1970 and, in fact, born 2 days before me. I established this when I went to Ethiopia. On the 8th of July, she had her Addis show, which was the first time she'd actually exhibited in Ethiopia, let alone on the continent of Africa. So she is well known for her large-scale abstract acrylic paintings. And she layers the acrylic, and then she overlays it with markings using pens and pencils. And her work is very, very bold. It's delicate, but bold. And it has very strong architectural elements to it. So she uses acrylic initially, and then she overlays this with these pens and pencils with very fine markings, and her work tends to talk to the environment, architecture, the city in terms of how it's densely populated in the 21st century. One of her most iconic pieces of work hangs at the entrance foyer to Goldman Sachs building in New York, and that she was paid $5 million. So she really is at the top of her game. So she makes me very, very proud to be African when I see her work. And she's also a wonderful, down-to-earth, laid-back woman. Another one, of course, is Ella Natsui, who comes from Ghana, based in Nigeria, though. He took these bottle tops, and he creates sheets of sheets. His last piece of work was called The Wall. I went to the Basel Art Fair a few months ago, and his work was displayed. It was absolutely incredible. So these small little links that he's created to create absolute sheets of tin.
Yes.
I think you have to actually see the work to appreciate how much has gone into it, how meticulous he has been in putting this work together. So he's another artist that is all the rage at the moment internationally, but he's been around for many years. He works very hard. He thinks about renewable issues around renewable products, etc. So those two, I would say, are some of the African artists that make me feel proud. And of course, as a South African, I couldn't not but mention William Kentridge.
Yes.
I mean, he is in a league of his own. He is regarded as the 9th most influential artist in the world.
Wow.
He is unbelievable. His work is incredible. And at the moment, actually, there's a at the Market Theatre downtown is one of his theatrical productions called Ubu and the Truth Commission, which historically actually was one of the was one of his works that really catapulted him onto the international platform. So we have
sure.
we have a growing heritage of superb contributors to the history of art, and it warms my heart actually that when I'm no longer, I'll at least be satisfied with the fact that we are beginning to see African artists form part of the canons of art. We are going down in the history books as people who have meaningfully contributed to art. Because, of course, if you look at the history of art over the ages, African artists still made significant contributions to art as we know it, but they were never recognized for this.
Sure.
I don't know whether you went to the Matisse exhibition at the Standard Bank Gallery recently, and I think the show is still on. But I was quite intrigued by the fact that we went for a walkabout with one of the curators, and there were two particular memories for me. One was where he showed us a painting where Matisse went to either Morocco or Tripoli with his wife, and it rained that he decided to paint. And one of the paintings was of a vase with flowers, and at the bottom of the vase was a little African statue. And he didn't spend too much time on it. He just sort of
sure.
It was a statue, and it was a statue, and we moved on, and there was a glass cabinet with Kuba cloth. And again, he just moved on. But what struck me about that was that both these pieces of African art played a fundamental role in his fame and his artistic influence. So in the context of that little doll, for instance, or the African sculpture, he had been invited to dinner in Paris a few months ago, and he decided to go via one of these trinkety shops, and he saw this particular doll in the window, this sculpture in the window. It's very small. And he bought it and took it to dinner. At that dinner was none other than Picasso.
Wow.
And that, as a consequence, the story goes, of Picasso seeing this sculpture, he decided to start researching African art. And you will see there's a very clear link between the sort of art that Picasso was painting at the time relative to how that artistic style and the forms changed as a consequence of seeing the sculpture and then further researching African art. If you look at the Matisse exhibition, there's a distinct influence of the lines and designs of that Kuba cloth throughout the works, including, by the way, the jazz series, which is so phenomenal and colorful, etc. But I wasn't lost on the fact that here you have two pieces of African art that form part of this exhibition, yet their influence across most of that art It was almost overwhelming to me.
Wow.
But what I also found distressing was the fact that it was almost not recognized and not given
yes.
the importance that it deserved.
Glossed over.
Absolutely.
You know, from Van Gogh to, you know, as you mentioned, Matisse to Picasso, you know, it's not just even the art, it's even Western sort of architecture that Africa has sort of influenced in so many ways. And one of the things I want us to close out on, because we only have another couple minutes, is the role of galleries
and how sort of the average sort of layman can get involved and sort of educate themselves so they can feel a greater sense of a stronger identity, a highest heightened awareness around who we are on this continent as a people and our role in the world and how the future will be shaped. Where does the average person start?
By walking into a gallery.
What's some of South Africa's best galleries to walk into?
There are all sorts. I mean, there are so many galleries in Johannesburg, in Cape Town. There are obviously your big galleries or established galleries, be it Gallery Momo, which is in Parktown North, the Everard Reed Gallery that's been going for years, the Goodman Gallery, the Stevenson Gallery, the Blank. There are so many of them. Lisa Moore, there are many, many galleries. And what they do, which I find very interesting for me, certainly on a Saturday morning, is that most of them have walkabouts. So depending on what the exhibition is that's up on show, not only do they have your opening evenings, etc., I happen not to like so many crowds. So I tend to go and actually listen to the artist speak on a Saturday morning about his work. And you can engage the artist, you can ask as many questions as you like. And it literally is a walk-in, walk-out. And all you need to do is check on the internet to see when the walkabouts are happening. There are also talks in the evenings. You also have places like the Bag Factory and August House in downtown Johannesburg where there are opportunities to see the work. There are also art fairs. So we have, there is the FNB Johannesburg Art Fair that's coming up next week, which I'm really looking forward to because the focus this year is on East African artists. And given my own background, having been born in East Africa, etc., it's, you know, it holds a very special place for me. And, of course, research on the internet. If you have access to the internet, there are so many applications that talk you through the history of art, that talk you through various artists. I find that for me, certainly it's very fulfilling to be able to look up the biographies of artists and understand. One of the things that I've started doing is as I buy a piece of art, I tend to want to meet the artist and I tend to want to spend time with them because I think that it gives you a greater appreciation of what it is that you're buying.
We've got 1 minute left before we segue into our cyber health feature. What's your favorite piece of art that you own?
I have very, very many that I own. There isn't a single piece of art that hangs in my house that I don't consider to be my favorite. But the first piece of art that you see when you walk into my house is a piece that is untitled by a young Zimbabwean artist called Kudzanai Chiurai. And he spent months at the Cape Town Slave Archives looking at trying to understand the history of slavery in the Cape. And what he produced, his interpretation of what he found, was nothing short of astonishing. For me, it moves me every single time I walk through the front door, because what he's done is on this large canvas, he has produced a slave master's journal, which shows the fact that slaves were renamed and that there were very few names they used and they were all the same. There were three or four names that were used. So he has this list of these slaves, the ages, and they had slaves as young as 4, believe it or not, 4 years old. And then there's a comment section where they talk about whether you're a deserter, whether you're a good slave, a bad slave, an okay slave. And then they talk to the price. And behind this journal is a picture, is a painting of a beautiful, beautiful woman who is bedecked in gaudy jewelry. So for me, the painting has a double meaning because it talks about how we were slaves in the context of the slave trade. But in this day and age, the contemporary interpretation of slavery also talks to how we are slaves to the material. So it leaves me feeling very uncomfortable most of the time. And that's how I like to feel in the context of my engagement with the art.
We are excited because we know your voice is evolving in this art space, particularly as it relates to, you know, art, how it deals with social injustices. And we're going to upload on the site some additional content from you, maybe even some video, some additional materials and so forth, so people can follow the trajectory of your evolution of your own sort of brand voice as well. Can we do that?
With pleasure.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolute delight. I learned so much. Rianette, wow. Like, I'm actually speechless. Do you have a favorite piece of art in your home?
I do, and I think it's like you said earlier, you know, each one has got so many memories attached to it. You remember where you bought it, how you felt that day, and so forth. So it's definitely, yeah, there's something special about it. So thank you. That was an incredible conversation.
And thank you.
It actually made me realize when you mentioned, like, we become slaves to, you know, we could become slaves to art. It leads into the discussion today for cyber health. And thank you for being part of the show with me, Rianette, from Safety Net Cyber Safety. We are going to talk about digital companionship. So it's, in a way, it's art in a different form. And if you consider how people are actually curating art nowadays, it's in a digital format as well, right? So, but today I would like to share quite interesting statistics with you, and you'll be surprised because for a change, the men are the one who actually made me laugh in terms of, let me start with this. If you sit in a waiting room waiting to see a doctor or someone, how long does it take you before you reach for your phone? Maybe 1 minute, 2 minutes. Most will say about 3 minutes. But an experiment conducted on behalf of Kaspersky Lab by the Universities of Würzburg and Nottingham Trent found that participants left in a waiting room on their own lasted an average of just 44 seconds before touching their smartphones. Men couldn't even manage half of this time, waiting an average of only 21 seconds compared to women 57 seconds.
Wow.
Personally, I think it's because we look at everything around us. We look at the artwork maybe and what magazines they are and so forth. To delve deeper into the comparison and the companionship of digital devices, after 10 minutes, participants were asked how long they thought it had been before they reached for their phones. Most said between 2 and 3 minutes, highlighting a significant disconnect between perception and actual behavior. So, commenting on their findings is Jens Binder from the University of Nottingham Trent, said that the experiment suggests that people are far more attached to these devices than they realize, and it has become second nature to turn to your smartphone when left alone with them. We do not just wait anymore. And that's a moment we can actually take to just take a breath, you know, to actually say, ah, let's just think about the day, what's next, and so forth, but we reach for our phones. The immediacy of information and interaction delivered through our smart devices make them much more of a digital companion and connection to the outside world than a piece of technology. And that word, companionship, to me, can be interpreted in many ways, and it can be good or bad. Because I wonder, if you are sitting in a waiting room, how many lost conversations are there? Potential friends, people you can inspire, you know, someone's having a hard day. So the digital companionship is a discussion. Additional research conducted by the universities suggests that this compulsion to check our phones could be as a result of fear of missing out. And we have spoken about FOMO, the fear of missing out, many times before. But Astrid Carolus from the University of Würzburg continues and says the more participants use their phone, the more they are afraid they're missing out when they aren't accessing it. It is difficult to say which attributes fuels which. Do people use the phone more because they are afraid of missing something, or because they are used to much more and worry about missing out? And I think we should do a show on that, because it's about that, the neuroscience things, Timothy, sure, you love so much. But the study found more that we use our phones more, and the more we use it, we become more stressed. However, yeah, when they spoke to those participants, it was quite interesting to hear that they actually didn't think so. But where it becomes important for us from a cyber safety point of view, it's important to remember, and David M., senior security researcher at Kaspersky Lab, mentions that on these devices, we have everything we love, our photos, and we think all our connections and so forth. We have to protect them from theft and so forth. So from a digital point of view, let's be safe on the digital highways. Let's keep our eyes and ears on the ground and not just focused on our smartphones. And I invite you to be part of our conversations at SaveteNet, SaveteNet.com. So thank you so much and have a fantastic week.
Thank you, Rionette. We really appreciate that. I mean, I realize that I know even in when I go to art fairs, for example, I'm intrigued by how many people are just looking down at their phone instead of at the actual art. And it's an extraordinary, I think we're in an extraordinary chapter of history. I do see a shift that's going to happen, though. And I'm really grateful to see you having such a strong conversation about the link between African history, where we are and where we're going forward. And I do think technology will play a role in that. So thank you so much, Polani. Thank you, Rionette. We'll be back next week with another Unbranded.
Cliffcentral.
Revolution.
I've got something important to tell you.
Cliffcentral.com.